With the soft sand in between your toes, the salty air sifting through your hair, and the sun shining on your shoulders, is there anything more relaxing than a day at the beach? For the Beaumont family in 1966, the answer is a million times yes. It was a warm summer morning in 1966, and people were flocking to the seaside to celebrate the one and only National Day of Australia. Families set up striped umbrellas and kids splashed in the waves in their bathing suits. Three such children, by the names of Jane, Arna, and Grant Beaumont, were looking to do just that. Their father, Jim, was a traveling salesman and currently away on a business trip, so Jane, the eldest of the three, had asked her mother if she could take the younger ones to the water. This was customary in 1960s Australia. The country was seen as a safe place to raise children. Kids ran free, neighbors were loved. Jane was known to be quite responsible for her age as well, so her mother Nancy agreed to the beach day, and the children began packing up their bags. Jane was sure to include her paperback copy of Louisa May Alcott's Little Women. She folded three beach towels for herself and her siblings, helped dress Arna and Grant in their swimming clothes, and the trio was off, with Nancy waving from the doorstep. This would mark the last time Nancy ever saw her children again. My name is Anne-Marie Luno, and this is Down the Rabbit Hole. At 8:45 a.m., the children, age 9, 7, and 4, boarded an early morning bus to Glenelg Beach. Glenelg was a sweet, quaint beach town close to home, nearly 2 miles from the Beaumont House in Somerton Park, a suburban neighborhood in Adelaide. It was a short ride, and in only 5 minutes, the children had arrived at the Mosley Street bus stop. The stop was across the road from Wenzel's Bakery, and only a couple blocks walk to the salty waves. They ran to the sand, excited to celebrate their national holiday. For Jane, Arna, and Grant Beaumont, though, Australia Day lasted forever. January 26, 1966 was a notably hot one, temperatures rising even early in the morning. The heat wave had pushed people to the shore, and though they arrived early, just before 9 a.m., the beach was already swarming with people. Jane, Grant, and Arna were expected to return later that day, on either the noon or the 2 p.m. bus. It was only meant to be a quick morning trip. At noon, Nancy Beaumont went to get her kids at the bus stop. With no children in sight, she simply assumed they had lost track of time. This wasn't a cause for concern, though, as they would be on the 2 p.m. bus later in the day. But when she returned at the bus stop 2 hours later, the children were once again not there. Nancy quickly grew concerned and became more and more worried when the children hadn't been on the 3 p.m. bus either. Jim Beaumont arrived early from his business trip a little after 3 p.m. Once Nancy informed him of the situation, he immediately got in the car to go find the children at Glenelg. Past the Mosley Street bus stop he drove, past Wenzel's Bakery, past the town hall, up and down along the streets, but still, Jane, Arna, and Grant were nowhere to be found. Jim soon returned home to pick up Nancy, and the two searched around the neighborhood for hours, walking the sidewalks, knocking on doors, and talking to friends and even strangers. So far, nobody knew of anything. The kids were not on the beach, nor at their friends' houses. Instead, they had simply vanished. At 5:30 p.m., after 2 hours of frantic searching, Jim and Nancy went to the Glenelg police station to report their children as missing. Mostyn Matters, who was working in South Australia as a police detective at the time, was on call at the Glenelg station when the couple arrived. He was the first person to speak to Jim and Nancy, and has since said that he remembers the meeting vividly. The couple frantically pacing back and forth, the fear felt throughout the entire session. He mentioned there were 6 hours at least that the children's disappearance was emergency broadcasted over the radios and TVs. Soon after the Beaumonts reported their children missing, the police had organized a search around the city. They began by thoroughly checking nearby beaches, optimistically hoping that Jane, Arna, and Grant had only lost track of time on the warm summer day. But as the hours ticked by with the broadcast in full force, those working at the station, along with family and friends of the Beaumonts, became increasingly concerned that something more serious may have happened. They soon expanded their search to include a monitoring of all transportation in and around the city. They looked at rail lines all along Adelaide, checked airports for sightings, and watched interstate traffic for any signs of kidnapping. With the search now fully underway, the police calculated that between the three children, there were 17 items with them, including Jane's copy of Little Woman. Surely something would show up, something would be found, like a dropped towel, a white canvas shoe, or even Jane's beach bag. But nothing came of that, not a shred of evidence. The items had yet to be found, and physical descriptions of Jane, Arna, and Grant were sent to locals around the area, and the small beach police station was soon swarming with people queuing out the door to offer information on possible sightings. The whole town was looking for these kids. Matters, the police detective who was on call when Jim and Nancy arrived, later said that the station was doing the best they could, but that it was simply small. He described the whole experience as impossible, saying nothing was really organized as it should have been. For example, they only had one phone line, making it difficult to pick up every call that came in. By the very next day, the entire country knew of the disappearance, with search parties now looking in the ocean water, in marinas, and even inside buildings along the shore. Thousands upon thousands of civilians went searching on foot. The Navy, Army, and the Air Force soon joined in on the search as well. It wasn't until days later, on January 29th, that Jim and Nancy had their first possible lead to finally finding their children. After hearing of the description sent out of Jane, Grant, and Arna, a woman had gone to the police station to give information. She told the authorities how she had talked to three small children on the evening of the 26th, who were similar to the Beaumonts' descriptions. According to her, they had been at the Patawalonga Boat Haven at around 7 p.m. This was it. After days of searching, days of no sleep, the children were finally going to be found. Authorities rushed to the scene, soon to be discouraged with no sight of the children. The haven was eventually drained, and still nothing was found. And this was only the first false lead. As media attention grew, the entire country was now looking for the three children. It began the largest missing persons search in the history of South Australia. Clues, hints, and potential sightings kept coming forward, with people eager to volunteer information about the case. After hearing countless perspectives, there was one particular story that many witnesses seemed to agree on. A person who was seen with the children right before they disappeared, the mysterious 30-something man. Standing approximately 6 feet 6 inches, or almost 200 centimeters, he was a tall man. Tall and thin even, with an athletic build and suntanned skin. He had a large forehead, above which rested a pile of neatly parted blonde hair. His thin, sulky face was clean-shaven, appearing put together with his navy swim shorts and a single white stripe down the sides. With him, he carried a shirt and pants which he had rested on a nearby park bench next to a single beach towel when he had first arrived at the beach that morning. Not only had people seen the blonde man with the children, but a few witnesses had been approached by him as well. They mentioned how the man was asking people around if anyone had seen the children's bags. He claimed they had money in them and that the bags had recently gone missing. None of the witnesses thought much of the encounter at the time, not until they were asked about it later by authorities. After many people came forward with similar information, the detectives working on the case came up with a theory. What if the man had taken the money from the children, then helped them ask around to find it? It was a likely tactic. With no money for food and no way to get home, he appeared like a savior to the vulnerable kids, somebody they could possibly trust. this could be the police's first real puzzle piece of the whole story. As the stories of the 30-something man came to light, witnesses also noted other suspicious activity that they had previously not thought much of. Apparently, the same tall, blonde man had been watching the children while they played in the water. Their three towels were laid out on the sand right next to his. After they'd gotten out of the water, they ran up to him playfully splashing. They seemed to know him quite well. The man then proceeded to dress them, right on the sand, which some thought seemed odd, as Jane, who was 9 years old at the time, appeared old enough to dress herself. Afterwards, the four packed up their belongings, all 17 items belonging to Jane, Arna, and Grant. They left the beach and went to a nearby changing station. The man went in to change, and the children waited outside for him. They then left the area at 12:15 p.m., all walking hand in hand. People who were interviewed noted the extreme comfortability the children seemed to have with the man, as if they had known him for their whole lives. When Jim and Nancy were given this information, they were taken aback, saying this was surprising and out of character. The three children, particularly Jane, were all quite shy. Not only this, but Jane was known to be extremely protective of her younger siblings. It was unlikely they would be so relaxed with a stranger, and that there was absolutely no way they would be this comfortable with an unknown man. This comment sparked curiosity in a shop attendant at Wenzel's Bakery, the cake shop located just across the road from the Mosley Street bus stop. The shop attendants at the bakery knew the children well, as these beach outings were quite common for Jane, Arna, and Grant. They had gone into Wenzel's Bakery many times before, and the attendants said the children were acting differently the morning of their disappearance. When interviewed, the workers recalled the last time they saw them, which was around 12:20 p.m. to 12:30 p.m., shortly after they left the beach with the mysterious man. Jane had bought 2 large fizzy drinks, 6 buns, and 5 pastries. She also got a meat pie, which was placed in a separate bag, and paid for the order with a £1 note. Although it's a seemingly innocuous bag of goodies, Jane's bakery order is curious for a few reasons. The police first noted the number of delicacies bought that day. It was much more than they had bought at their previous trips to the bakery, and it was unlikely that amount of food would be needed for only a single day at the beach. Then the issue of money came up. Nancy had given the children 6 shillings and 6 pence, which was only enough for their bus fare and lunch. However, Jane had paid for the pastry order with a £1 note. How did she get the £1 note? Lastly, the shop attendants at Wenzel's Bakery said that they have never once seen Jane or any of the siblings order a meat pie. This led police to figure the children had most likely been with another person the day of their disappearance. Around this time, Nancy Beaumont remembered a comment Arna made to her recently. Arna had said Jane had gotten a boyfriend down at the beach. The comment was initially brushed off by Nancy, who assumed Jane had simply made a new friend. The information from the bakery led Nancy to rethink that comment entirely. Because of that comment, Nancy considered that maybe the children knew the man they were with after all. At 3 p.m. that day, the children were seen by their postman, who was considered a reliable source, as he knew the kids quite well. He said he saw them walking alone in the direction of their own house, and that they were walking in the main street, laughing and holding hands. This seemed peculiar since the shy, responsible kids would probably not be walking so casually if they were over an hour late for curfew. The postman soon changed his story though, saying he may have actually seen them in the morning, not in the afternoon. Late on the evening of the 26th of January, another woman may have seen the Beaumonts. She said she saw a single man with 3 children go into a nearby house in her neighborhood. She had thought the home was vacant all this time, and later that night, the little boy was seen walking alone down the lane. He was chased by the man before being caught and taken back into the house. This was all she saw that night, and the very next morning, the house was seemingly empty again. However, the woman didn't report the sighting until months later, leading the police to wonder why it had taken her so long to come forward. Back at the Beaumont house, loved ones were gathered to offer comfort and support while the search continued. It was a painful time. Only 2 days after their children had gone missing, Nancy was placed under sedation by local doctors. Their home was soon equipped with a telephone for easy access and contact to the Glen Elg police station. The mysterious disappearance of the Beaumont children had now captivated listeners. This was unusual for Australia, which was a safe and innocent place at the time. People were eager to help put the pieces of the story together. Days into the investigation, the sightings of the children continued to flood into the police station. Jim and Nancy now had become acquainted with the press. They did interviews, Jim appeared on television, and the couple was constantly pleading for the safe return of their three children. The calls for information and the possible sightings continued. There were so many, the police were still unable to look into each and every one. In November of that same year, the police were now desperate for some kind of evidence. Any kind of evidence. They hired a Dutch parapsychologist and psychic named Gerard Quassay to help search for the children. He arrived in Australia on November 8th. Unfortunately, his stories of the missing children seemed to change each and every day, leaving little trust in his theories. There was one, though, that seemed to intrigue those following the case closely. He said he saw an image of the children in his mind, located in an old brick warehouse kiln. He said he knew they were there. The building had just recently been surfaced with new concrete, and Quassay believed the children had been buried underneath it. This would make sense since the warehouse was actually a building site when the children went missing back in January. There was a public pleading to excavate the building, but the owners didn't want to go to such great lengths based on the comments of a psychic. Because of this, the public raised money, eventually coming in at $40,000. At this, the owners succumbed to the pressure and the building search was soon underway. But it was only another lost cause, an expensive lost cause. After the search, the police and authorities were left with no new information. No bodies, no belongings, no evidence at all. In 1996, the same building was going through a partial demolition. The owners allowed again for a full search, but once more, they found nothing at all. Things were not starting to look up, as any new information was either proven inaccurate or it led authorities to another dead end. Everything from false leads to conspiracy theories left any chance of finding the children few and far between. That was until 2 years after their disappearance, when Jim and Nancy received a handwritten letter from Jane. Along with her letter, there was another from an unknown man. The letters were sent from Dandenong, Victoria. In her note, although brief, Jane describes a relatively nice life. She said the man was keeping them. In his note, the man wrote to tell the Beaumont parents that, although he had become their guardian, he was willing to still give the children back. He penciled in a place in the letter for them to meet at a designated time. Jim and Nancy went to the meeting place at the requested time, and they hired a detective to follow behind them as well. Unfortunately, it was yet another broken wire. Nobody showed up, and the parents were devastated. This would be the only communication they ever received for quite some time. A while later, they got a third letter in Jane's handwriting. In the letter, Jane explained how the man who was keeping them had truly been willing to give them back, but that he had seen the detective following behind them and decided he could no longer trust the Beaumont parents. Instead, he would be keeping the children for good. That was the last letter they ever received. It wasn't until 1992 when newly advanced forensic technology had proven the letters to be a hoax all along. The fingerprints on the letter were not Jane's, but a middle-aged man who had been a young teenager at the time. He said he sent the letters as a joke. And due to the statute of limitations, the man was never charged. As the decades passed, Jim and Nancy grew quiet. They withdrew themselves from the public eye. They no longer did interviews or any press. Traumatized from the jokes, they stopped answering questions about their children, and they stopped reaching out to the media entirely. The parents eventually separated in the early 1970s as the heartbreak distanced them from one another. Although separated, Jim and Nancy kept their home in Adelaide for as long as they emotionally could, hoping through all these years that their children may one day return. In interviews, Nancy had said many times how it would be dreadful for the children to return to an empty house. The rooms of Jane, Arna, and Grant were left entirely untouched, still in the hopes that they may one day find their rooms just as they had left them. It was only recently that they sold their home in Somerton Park. Nancy Beaumont has since passed away, dying in a nursing home at age 92 in 2019. Jim, also in his 90s now, is alive and still living in Adelaide. This tragic and disturbing story was a turning point for Australia. As mentioned earlier, it was common practice for children to take buses alone, ride bikes unsupervised, and walk the streets without a parent present. Jim and Nancy were simply following the trends of the time, living in what was known as the epitome of community. That warm summer day in January was devastating for the country. From then on, parents became more guarded, suspicious of strangers. The mystery of Jane, Arna, and Grant Beaumont has haunted the country since. For decades, their disappearance will be known as the loss of Australia's innocence. It was, and still is, a tragic moment in history, a case that somehow remains active even now, as the Glenelg Police Station say they'll continue looking until the day the children are found. So maybe there is one thing more relaxing than a day at the beach: to come home afterward. Thank you for listening to today's episode on the missing Beaumont children. For another Australian unsolved mystery, check out episode 7 of this very show titled The Unknown Man. If you appreciate the content and research, please leave me a review on Apple Podcasts so that more listeners like you can find my work. I have extra content from this and every episode on my Instagram at @drh_pod and a transcript and sources on my website drhpod.com. There you can also leave me a case suggestion so that I can tell the stories that matter to you. And as always, I will see you next time when you follow me down the rabbit hole.